How do you know you're up to date? When you follow EMS World, you answer that question with confidence. Because when we say EMS World, we mean the whole world of EMS. The remaining question for you is, how will you stay up to date? In print, online, at EMS World Expo, the world's largest EMS dedicated conference, and now in a podcast.
It's pretty easy to see generally in retrospect whether we should have been in system one or system two thinking or the framework we were in. That's when you're doing QI or QA. I think the trick is realizing this while the patient's in front of you.
We actually built this as a pyramid, and the bottom layer of that pyramid was culture. That's the foundation for all of this, because without it, none of it's going to work.
I'm Ginger Locke from the Medic Mindset podcast. Thanks to EMS World, I've gotten access to some of the speakers who will be at EMS World Expo in New Orleans. This is the first episode in a series of discussions with educators speaking there. Today, I'm talking to Brandon Means and Brian Bean about their talk called Better Choices, 10 Tips for Improving Clinical Judgment. Brandon is a paramedic, a nurse, and works for mobile health tech company Pulsera. And Brian is a critical care paramedic who works in Colorado and has been involved in QA/QI and education. And together, they've set out to help us understand how our brains work, how clinicians make decisions. We start with Brandon describing how their collaboration began.
I feel like I've known Brian forever. I looked back and our first conversation was in Facebook Messenger back in 2015. Every month or two, just a random, hey, I'd like to bounce something off of you, you know, some pharmacology question or ventilator question. Starting a year ago, we started talking about this presentation that's coming up at EMS World. That's when we really started talking a lot and decided to do this together, started working on it together. And we met by, you know, Zoom meeting or phone calls and text. But we did 90% of the work before we ever met each other.
Can you say what the topic is, what you guys are going to be talking about at EMS World Expo?
We've pivoted so many times since we initially set down this path. The overall topic is decision-making. The class name, I think, is Better Decisions and 10 Tips for Improving Clinical Judgment or something along those lines. Brian probably knows the exact title.
I think at this point, it's going to be 10-ish tips. I think we're trying to avoid kind of a, here's a huge data dump, and next, here's the next topic. But yeah, it is on clinical decision-making.
And that's why I wanted to talk to you guys, because I love clinical decision-making. And I think the reason I love it is because the more I dug into it, the more I understood why I had made some errors that I made. It was like a big relief to realize that there are known pitfalls, I guess, cognitive pitfalls that are kind of a universal human experience. And it made me feel less alone in some of the errors I had made.
I think that's exactly right. And actually, to build on that a little bit, I think before I got into quality assurance, I was kind of a jerk, if I can give you an honest self-assessment. And I think through quality assurance and actually seeing the things you're talking about, Ginger, it made me a slightly better person. I mean, I say that very hesitantly, but I think a lot more compassionate about, you know, I understand why this happened and why people made these misjudgments.
So what are the internal and external factors that impact our decisions, or what are some of the things that lead to good or poor judgment?
That's a big question to unpack. And I think we kind of struggled a little bit with, there's all this information out there, right? There's cognitive biases. There's, you know, if your culture isn't right, there's mental models. So we really tried to break this down into, how do we explain this in 75 minutes? There's a few cognitive biases, which are, it's just shortcuts that your brain takes, because that's how we're wired. You know, if we're on the plains of Africa and you see a thing and it looks like a tiger, you're hardwired to say, ooh, that's a tiger, I should run. You don't want to sit there and say, is it a tiger? Is it a jaguar? Is it a leopard? Is it this or that? Sort of unpacking kind of how the brain works and how it processes information was a hard task.
Do you feel like you've done it?
I feel like we have a pretty good handle on it at this point. Yeah.
What resources did you guys use to dig into that?
Well, I got about 40 books here.
One resource that I found online that's free, anybody could go to it. It's First 10 EM. They have Justin Morgenstern has a whole series. I think it's a 4 blog post where he writes about cognitive pitfalls. I found that one to be probably one of the more comprehensive ones and accessible because it's free. Of those 40 books, were there some that were more useful than others?
Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow was a really good book. It's a little bit dry, but it really is kind of the foundation of a lot of this. I think the book that probably had the single biggest impact on me is a book by Sidney Decker called The Field Guide to Human Error. Every time I go back to that book, probably once a year, and reread it, it's just kind of mind-blowing. The first time you read it, you're going to be like, eh. But then when you kind of let those ideas marinate, they're really simple, but they're really profound. This book, Cognitive Errors and Diagnostic Mistakes by Jonathan Howard, just came out a couple of months ago, but it's really an amazing text on cognitive errors and medicine and how we get led astray by our brains.
So what are some of the ways that we do get led astray?
You know, the big one is a fixation error. And this is one of the reasons planes crash and one of the reasons we harm patients is we get fixated on something. You know, intubation is kind of the classic one where people think, if I just get this piece of plastic in that hole, all my problems are going to be solved. Anything outside of that 3-inch screen, if you're using video, goes away. And I've done this. Just try to pass a tube and the patient is dying and we're not aware of it.
Why do we have fixation error? Why do we do that?
It's natural for us to stick with what we know, and we tend to oversimplify things when we do that. I know that if I focus in and just look at this screen or just look at this airway, I generally know what I'm looking at right there. And I don't have to, it's just oversimplified. I don't have to think about everything else. And we get caught up in that and we lose track of time. And as we started to research this and develop these pages of notes, you know, look at this in every area of our lives. In the hyperacute phase of patient care, the stakes are high. And so we have to really be cognizant of this.
You're right that it's some, all the parts of our lives, because Daniel Kahneman, who you referenced earlier, Brian, his area is actually economics, and we've been able to apply that to medicine.
To build on what Brandon said, when you have that stressful situation and there's adrenaline and cortisol, your brain narrows down. It wants to think in binary of yes, no. It doesn't want to consider options and kind of engage in that system two thinking, because that requires energy. It's super hard to do when you're stressed out to get out of that mode of act, and to stop and just kind of hang out in that storm for a second and think about, what other options do I have here? And what am I trying to accomplish? I'm not trying to intubate this person. I'm trying to manage their airway, and I have options. It's crazy, because you wouldn't think it would happen, and you'll say, that'll never happen to me. After it does, you're like, whew.
And there have been accounts of this happening in the airline industry, aviation.
Oh, yeah. That's where most of this comes from.
That's a good point, Ginger. You know, going through these pages of references, all of the references that we found, or I'd say most of the references that we found, were either in economics or business or aviation, not very much in healthcare, but it's there are a lot of parallels how they apply.
Brian, earlier you referenced system two thinking, system one and two thinking. Can you, for the listeners, explain those two?
So system one is an automatic thought process for the most part. If you don't have to put a whole lot of thought into it, it doesn't use a lot of energy. It doesn't really distract you from your situational awareness. System two is a lot harder. It uses a lot more energy, a lot more brain power. It's draining. System two is when you have to kind of think about the future a little bit, which is not something any other animal can do. You have to think, what could happen? What could be the consequences of these actions? Or you have to think, what are my options here? Even just listing a differential diagnosis is delving into system two, because you have to use brain power. You have to do some mental computation to get that. So system one, you know, if I'm outside and I see a fire coming towards me, I don't need to put a lot of thought into it. I go, ooh, fire, I should run. But if it's further away, you know, I have time to come up with a plan. Like, should I go help? Should I go home and get my valuables out? I can plan and think about different futures that might occur.
Right.
So knowing when to use one and two is fundamentally important. For the most part, a lot of problems happen when we're in system one and we should be in system two.
So would you say...
And I think the trick...
And some of this...
Oh, we all three spoke at the same time. That was exciting.
I love it.
You go, Brandon.
A big piece of this is, it's pretty easy to see generally in retrospect whether we should have been in system one or system two thinking, or the framework we were in. That's, you know, when you're doing QI or QA, I think the trick is realizing this while the patient's in front of you and while you're in the middle of this. And so that's what we're really seeking to find out, how, what's the best way to do this? There's not a ton of resources as it relates to this specific framework during the acute phase or the hyperacute phase of a problem, finding yourself in the midst of chaos where you're just trying to maybe just act like Brian's example of, is that a tiger? Is that a lion? I don't really care. My first order of business is run. To avoid that situation in patient care, to avoid being in chaos and to live more in a complex or complicated environment where I think we should live most of the time. I think we get in trouble by oversimplifying. Sometimes we find ourselves in chaos because of that, because we get that tunnel vision, right? Or the false dichotomy and some of these other logical fallacies that bring us into chaos and then we're in trouble.
It's really easy to figure out after the fact when you're doing this post-mortem of your decisions and looking back and saying, oh, well, when I was in that moment, you know, I decided to go that direction. And it sounds like what you guys have bitten off, what you're going to try to do at Expo is, this is how your brain works. Prepare for it to have these known errors. And then here are some tools to help mitigate some of those errors. Is that what you're going to, that's a big task. Is that what you guys are going for?
That's a big task. Yeah. And some of it's easy, right? Some of it's obvious. And so for those things, the 1+1=2 scenarios, which we don't see a lot of in an unpredictable environment. We get into problems by approaching an unpredictable situation or a complicated situation with simplistic views. There's a definite cause and effect relationship between what needs to happen and what I can do, then that's pretty simple. But those are few and far between. Those are things like recipes and drawing up a medication dose that's, you know, not necessarily weight-based or simple math. But then we get into problems by applying those concepts to situations that maybe need more analysis or to be broken down more.
It's like you have to be paranoid. It's like, if it feels simple, be suspicious.
I think that being paranoid about your own thought process is huge. I think it's the key, or a key.
Yes, everyone be paranoid.
Yeah.
And somehow creating a culture where it's okay to let other people give you feedback about where you are in the moment, hopefully kind of where this is all moving, is once we can self-reflect, we get the humility, we get the kind of guidebook of, oh, this is how our brain operates. And we're okay with other people commenting on how my brain is operating in a stressful moment.
Ginger, you're spot on. And I think that only relying on our own ability to recognize that we're viewing this from the wrong angle or in the wrong mindset, it sets us up for failure. And so 100% agree that without a proper culture, without being able to speak up, without that culture, this doesn't really work. As humans, we will never 100% be able to always be self-aware to the extent that we need to be.
We actually built this as a pyramid, and the bottom layer of that pyramid was culture. That's the foundation for all of this, because without it, none of it's going to work. And so having, you know, a just culture and a learning culture, one where people are receptive to hearing different opinions, was really the foundation. And getting that is hard. It's harder than you think. It's easy to say you have it, but actually having it, that's a whole different ball of wax.
Have what? Have the humility?
Have the right culture. It's easy to say, we have just culture. We have the just culture algorithm and follow that. But to really get people to buy into it, the check is like when a call goes bad. If people are all supporting each other, it's great. What usually happens is people are like, man, did you hear what so-and-so did? I think there could be a disconnect that a lot of administrators think they have this in place, but if it's not at the street level, you don't have it.
And you're really fighting human nature, because it seems like a natural defense mechanism to think, that I would never make that mistake, because it's just too scary to think that we ourselves might be that fallible.
You know, right now with no stressors, I'm never going to make a mistake. But you add a bunch of stressors, a bunch of goal conflict, variables, make things a little cloudy, and anyone can make a mistake.
Sure. Yeah. When the spotlight's on you, it's just, you instantly lose half your brain power. At least I do.
One of the tools that I've come across in reading some of this stuff is always attempt to disconfirm yourself. Always be asking these kind of contrary questions, especially with differential diagnosis. What else could this be? Or are there parts of this story that don't fit my differential? You're always having to push towards disconfirming your momentum. If you can do some of that out loud, you may be role modeling what you want other people to help you with. Ask me these questions.
You want to avoid that confirmation bias. That really rests on that foundation of the culture, though, that it's okay to have disconfirming opinions, and people disagreeing with your idea doesn't mean they don't like you. They just have a different idea. But when you get kind of, you know, some of the power hierarchies that some services have, it's hard to get those. So sometimes the leaders, who's ever in charge, who has the power, has to invite those. Like, does anyone see any holes in my logic, any flaws here, any other ideas? What are we missing? But that has to come from the top. It doesn't work if it comes from the bottom up. It's got to be top down.
Yeah, and I think that's where things like checklists or references that are not made in the heat of the moment or using your partner to do that. It's almost a necessity to do that in order to, you know, eliminate or to greatly reduce the bias. I like to think of it as like a 12 lead, an ECG. And so if you're just looking at the heart from a certain lead, you might be 100% correct that this is what I see from this angle, but it doesn't give you the big picture. Whenever you start combining those leads and looking at the big picture, we can consider using our resources and our partners and our colleagues as different leads to the ECG. Then we get a holistic view of maybe what's going on. And even if we're just by ourselves, taking a step back and say, okay, I see this from lead two, but now I'm going to take a step back and look, you know, from another angle. Just knowing that and having that mindset, I think helps.
When you look at like disasters out there, like NASA has a whole string of disasters, right? Like the Challenger and Columbia. Or you look at medicine, like if you guys you probably both have seen the Elaine Bromley video, the reenactment. For anyone who hasn't, man, that is intense and it should be required. But in all these disasters, someone on the periphery usually is aware of what's going on. They just can't get that across. They can't get those people out of the tunnel vision or, you know, get through their defenses and their bias to be like, listen, there's a problem here. Had those people invited the people on the periphery to speak up, to offer opinions, to kind of de-bias things, I think there'd be different outcomes.
I think your talk is going to be about wisdom. It's how to make really nuanced decisions under this extreme pressure cooker environment of emergency medicine.
I put a lot more weight in wisdom now than I do knowledge, because knowledge is, you can always create a reference for knowledge. But wisdom is something you kind of have to just develop. I think whenever I was a younger clinician, I was so reluctant to admit that I'd made a mistake. I would either just ignore it or apply it to, oh, well, that was just a sick patient. You know, there's nothing we could do, or blame someone else. Learning to that it's okay to make mistakes, forgiving yourself for those and learning from those. Once you get to that point, you can start making progress really quickly.
The more I've researched decision making in life and love and medicine, I kind of get a little fatalistic about it. It's almost like our brains, y'all use the word buggy. We're error prone in decision making. If nothing else, hopefully out of your talk, I mean, I think they're going to leave with, for sure, learning a little bit about their operating system, like how their brain works. I think they're going to learn, like, okay, it works in predictable fashion. These cognitive errors, we can expect them to happen. We want to bring in some tools to help mitigate that where we can. But at the heart of it, like when they walk out of that room, I'm hoping that they learn just to forgive themselves a little bit and cut themselves a little slack.
I hope the same. I hope that they can walk out of the room, first of all, knowing that, wow, I've been making some bad decisions I didn't know I was making, but that we also provide them with a way to, you know, through culture and through training and communication and self-forgiveness, that they can, you know, change that and doesn't have to be that way.
If you guys, I don't know if you're familiar with the term second victim syndrome at all.
Yeah, I've heard that.
It's kind of fascinating to look into. And, you know, I'll be honest, I think I had a little bit of it after a bad call that, you know, was my fault. I made some mistakes. And man, I spent a month in a dark, dark place. Not one of like PTSD, but just one of, I think I'm going to quit. And I was close. I was like, I think I'm going to quit EMS. It was sort of, maybe that's one of the transformative moments I had. I don't ever want to make anyone else feel like this doing quality assurance, because when it's a quality assurance guy who screws up, somebody else had to kind of step into my role. They didn't handle it that well. And man, I felt really bad about just everything for a month. Like, I'm a bad paramedic and I think I'm going to quit. And then kind of slowly work through it. But I think there's a real need here for people to understand that, yeah, everyone is going to make a mistake, and we really need to take care of each other when that happens. The first thing I'm doing now, or I guess I'm not really doing QA, but a little bit, I get phone calls or emails. Hey, this happened. How are you? Are you okay with it? Like, how are you doing? They're not calling me in the heat of the moment. You know, it's after, but how are you doing with this? And I think just that shift is huge of knowing that the people who made the mistake are going to suffer a lot too. And we really need to support them.
So what day are y'all talking? Do you know?
Yeah. I'm laughing because, yeah, Ginger, if I asked you to say, I want you to come up with the worst lineup to speak against at a conference, right?
I already have it. Maybe we have the same one.
We do.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, there are so many great presentations at the same time that we're doing ours. So we've already got a plan B. If only a couple people show up, we're just going to go listen to you and we'll catch them up later.
So are we speaking at the same time?
We are, as is Dr. Jarvis and Dave Olvera.
Hillary Gates, we're coming for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Hillary's got some answering to do.
They're looking to record all the talks so they can make them available after the conference.
I think that's a wonderful idea.
Me too.
I'm also horrified about it, but yes, I think it's a good idea. I just got to choose my outfit better.
Well, I've taken up too much of y'all's time already. Thank y'all.
I loved it.
Yeah, this is great. Thank you for having us.
The wheels are turning in a little bit different direction now on some things. So you have a way of doing that. And that's why I love talking to you.
This really clarified things, Ginger. I think take another tangent here.
Ooh, cool.
You really help us kind of reach deep down into what we've been trying to put into words, but have been struggling to. So thank you.
You're welcome. And thank you guys for doing the hard work. This is no easy topic. Like, you've picked a tough topic, but an important one though, because I think this is where medics suffer and not many people are talking about it because they may not even know it. They don't even have the language for it, for when they make an error, and you're going to give that to them. I'm so thrilled.
This has been an episode of EMS World Podcast. You can find this audio and more like it on the podcast page of emsworld.com. You can also follow EMS World on Twitter and Facebook. And I'll see you in New Orleans in October for EMS World Expo.
Does this apply in other areas like relationships?
Mm-hmm. Well, I said love on purpose.
I know. It's
yeah. Yeah, we can branch out. We've been selling ourselves short just doing EMS conferences, guys. We should really take this out there.
Right?
Brian and I are speaking at a marriage conference next month. Yeah.
I love you guys.
My true passion is definitely taking care of patients and being a patient advocate and being a paramedic and a nurse. That's why I still fly part-time on the helicopter and am involved in a ground service as well. So I try to do that as much as I can, as long as it doesn't pee on my Pulsera stuff.
Yes, I love it that there was a doorbell and a dog.
Oh, good. This mic's working really well. So, yeah, we also have a dog.
Just one? It sounds like 20.